Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity.
To introduce James Laidlaw. Do not be fooled by his age. James is a very distinguished anthropologist indeed. He's the author of several books in anthropology. He's a Cambridge lecturer at Cambridge University. His important books are Riches and Renunciation, which is a study in ethnography of Jains. It's the result of Dr. Laidlaw's work in Rajasthan among Jain traders there. He has another very important book on theory of ritual called Archetypal Actions of Ritual, in which he presents quite an original and unique theory on ritual, which by now those of you who are attending the lectures know about. Also important books on the work of Edmund Leach. Some of you might know that at Cambridge there is a kind of genealogy of anthropologists, and if I'm not mistaken, Leach was the supervisor of James's ex-supervisor. So anthropologists have their own genealogies as well. And Dr. Laidlaw is I think, the major contemporary writer on and analyst of Edmund Leach's work. Edmund Leach is, as you know, one of the key anthropologists of the 20th century. He's also writing, in the process of finishing, I believe, another book, and that's called Ritual and Memory, due to be published later this year, if I'm not mistaken. As I said, many, many publications to his name. He also presented the Malinowski Lecture at the School of Economics in London, obviously, in 2001, at which I had the privilege to be present. Very huge crowds there, and that was a lecture on the anthropology of ethics. If I sound a bit starry, that's because James was my supervisor at Cambridge. I think that's one of the reasons why. But as I said, very distinguished anthropologist, very prominent anthropologist, and today he will be talking to us about sacrifice, I believe.
Suicide.
Suicide. About suicide. Yes. I think there was a change of plans at some point. That's why I thought it was sacrifice. So he'll be talking to us about suicide with reference to the Jains of Rajasthan. So it should be very interesting, ethnographically as well as theoretically. To you.
The title of this paper is A Life Worth Leaving, and the paper is about the place within a conception of a good life, of the idea and practice of a good death. During the fieldwork I conducted in the 1980s and 90s on the Jain religion in the North Indian city of Jaipur, very many people explained to me at different times what they thought were the most important points about their religion, and they did so in a variety of ways. Some told stories about the miraculous lives of great saints of the distant past. Others described popular customs or practices they thought particularly admirable and distinctive of their own religion. Vegetarianism figured prominently here. An astonishingly large number attempted a from-the-ground-up description of the fundamental assumptions and theological principles of their religion. And of course, a lot described real-life people and the ways in which they were exemplars of what their religion ideally ought to be in practice, people they had known. These exemplars were both men and women, rich and not so rich. They tended to be people my informants had known or met personally. They were also virtually all dead. Now, of course, one could simply put down that fact, the fact that they were virtually all dead, to statistics. An awful lot more people are dead than are currently alive. Or it might be because until someone actually is dead, you can't be sure that they're not going to behave badly in some way, to do something that will lose them their exemplary status. But there's also another reason. When people came to describe why it was that this person was such a good example of how to live a good Jain life, the manner of their death always played a prominent part in the story. Let me take as an example Mr. Amachanji Nahar, who had lived in Jaipur city until just a few years before I first went there. I learned about him first from his daughter, who is herself a Jain nun. Her father, she said, was a real Jain, even though he was a householder and not a renouncer himself, with a family and not a lifelong celibate monk. He was actually stricter, she said, in his application of Jain teaching to his life, even than many monks. In his youth, he'd been a successful businessman and made a lot of money, but had retired early in favour of his sons. I was shown by one of these sons around the splendid urban mansion still occupied by his extended family, and taken to the single, tiny, windowless room which Amachanji occupied for over a decade, the last decade of his life. It had been preserved as a kind of shrine, almost exactly as it had been when he had lived there. Bare floors and walls, a single thin mattress on the floor, a single wooden bowl in which he had taken his food, and the clock he had used to regulate his life. Times were set for the prayers, confessions, meditations, and other ritual devotions with which most of his time, like that of a Jain monk or nun, was largely taken up. And in addition to the clock was a calendar which he used to regulate his fasting. Amachanji fasted at least every alternate day for the last several years of his life, and he also undertook repeated, more extended fasts. Jainism provides a complex repertoire of these, of which I'll say a little more below. Even on days when he wasn't fasting, he progressively, as the years went by, simplified and reduced what he ate, his daily allowance of grains and water being carefully weighed for him by members of his family. He became known among Jains in the city as something of an expert on fasting. People came to him for advice before taking vows to fast themselves, and even more commonly, they came to him at the end of their fast to take their first food from his hands. Breaking a lengthy fast is a quite dangerous procedure, and Amachanji was acknowledged as an expert on how much of which kind of foods could be safely taken. On the mattress in his room, there are now two large paintings propped up against a wall. One of Amachanji himself, sitting as he would have done for most of the last decade of his life, wearing only a loincloth, cross-legged with his palms folded upwards on his lap. Next to him, dressed and sitting in the same fashion, is a similar large portrait of his hero and model, a man called Rajchandra Mehta, who lived across the turn of the 20th century in Bombay. Mehta, too, was a businessman in his youth who became a celebrated lay holy man. He's partly famous because of his friendship with Mahatma Gandhi, who singled him out in his writings as one of the three people of recent times who had most influenced him. But independent of this advertisement from the Mahatma, Rajchandbhai, as he is known, has to this day quite a large lay following among devout Jains. There's no marked facial resemblance between Amachanji and his more famous predecessor, but at first sight, the two portraits look very strikingly alike. And the reason for that is that they are both so shockingly thin. On both, each rib stands out quite clearly on their chest, and the bones, veins, and sinews of their arms and legs are similarly distinct. Their stomachs recede deeply beneath their rib cages, and their heads both look quite unnaturally large as well as bony, in contrast with the rest of their bodies. At the age of 32, Rajchandbhai ended his life by undertaking a fast to death. And Amachanji, though much older when he did so, ended his life in the same way. This practice of fasting to death is called salekana, a word with rather obscure origins, or more commonly, samadhimaran, which literally means death while in meditation. Amachanji's daughter swelled with pride as she described to me his fast and death. Even though he was already an old man, she said, His final fast lasted for a full 36 days. For the last 24 days, he did not take even water. Even on the last day, he was sitting up and saying his Samaic under his breath. Samaic is a meditational prayer which most devout Jains say each morning. And everyone could see, she said, how peaceful and calm he was. The house was full of people. They came every day just for the sight of him. Many people themselves took vows to fast until my father should have breathed his last. On the last day, everyone said there was a scent of saffron in the air as they came into the house, and right at the end, people said they heard a loud cracking noise in the air just as he died. When they looked, a wound had appeared on the crown of his head. Historically and philosophically, Jainism is a first cousin to Buddhism, founded at the same time, the 4th century BC, in the same region of North India, and like it, a religion of world renunciation, though with a notably greater emphasis on asceticism as a way of achieving spiritual purification and enlightenment. It's the religion of a small but influential and well-established population in all parts of India. Small groups of monks and rather more such groups of nuns are the objects of intense veneration by a larger lay population, most of which is urban and reasonably affluent. In fact, mostly business people of one kind or another. The renouncers travel in small single-sex groups of between two and at most a dozen or so, moving more or less continuously between towns and villages, always travelling on foot, always walking barefoot, and carrying all their possessions with them, teaching as they go the importance of the two cardinal Jain religious and moral virtues, non-possession and non-violence. Jainism is a religion of apparent paradoxes. Non-attachment and non-possession are cardinal values. Monks and nuns are required, and all lay Jains are enjoined to keep their material possessions and needs to a minimum. Yet the Jains are among the wealthiest of India's minority communities and are concentrated overwhelmingly in business, trade and finance, with a traditional specialisation in much of rural India in local informal money lending, a profession not most known for being occupied by people not concerned about possessions. Jainism is the oldest and an explicitly heterodox religious tradition in India. From its origins, a radical rejection of central tenets of Hindu thought, ritual, and caste order. Yet in contemporary politics, Jains are firmly aligned with quote-unquote Hindu revivalism. Indeed, they figure prominently in the main Hindu political parties. And a third apparent paradox, the one that concerns me here, the one thing that most people know about Jainism, and what every Jain, him or herself, will emphasize if asked, is its extreme and uncompromising insistence on non-violence. Yet here we have the most fulsome celebration of what is basically religious suicide, premeditated and deliberate self-killing. Now, Amarchandji Nahar, the old man I described a little above, was fairly exceptional. That's why he's locally famous. But in practicing religious suicide by fasting to death, he was by no means unique. The practice is described in detail and commended in some of the earliest canonical texts of Jainism, and has been consistently portrayed as one of the highest ideals ever since. There's extensive epigraphic evidence to confirm that these ideals have pretty well always been put into practice. If anything, the practice has become more widespread and prominent in Jainism over time. Almost certainly in the beginning, it was confined to renouncers, to the monks and nuns. This changed fairly early, and evidence from the medieval period makes it clear that it was also a lay practice. But as with Buddhism, Jainism during the 20th century has gone through a series of what we may for convenience call Protestantizing changes, the adoption by laity of religious practices that had been more or less the preserve of renouncers, with of course consequent changes in the practices themselves. This has happened with fasting to death. Although strictly speaking all suicide is illegal under the Indian Penal Code, fasting to death both by renouncers and lay people today is not uncommon. And when they occur, they are covered extensively in the media. large crowds gather, and the event is celebrated in lavish public ceremonies, in which the persons who are in the process of ending their lives are explicitly identified as an exemplar of non-violence. Like the other apparent paradoxes I mentioned about Jainism, this one dissolves on close inspection, as I hope to be able to explain. So my purpose in this paper is to try to describe and convey the ethical sensibility to which this form of death belongs, to describe why it isn't intention, but is instead in perfect harmony with the Jain values of non-violence, to describe the form of life in which it looks like a self-evidently good death, and indeed an integral, if not exactly a necessary part, of a wholly good religious life. Samadhi Maran, death by fasting, is importantly not like martyrdom. It's not like what we might think of as our simplest ideas of martyrdom, the idea simply of accepting death, usually at the hands of an enemy of one's religion or other beliefs, rather than betraying or renouncing those beliefs. In this, in martyrdom, although one makes a choice, the choice to accept death, the act of killing is not one's own in an important sense. And the death, while good on account of the cause it is born for, is not in itself a good. It's the price, itself evil and to be regretted, of something which is good. And Samadhi Maran is also not like more complex ideas of martyrdom, such as the martyrology that played an important role in shaping both late antique Judaism and Christianity. Here we find the idea of the martyr's death not just as a price worth paying, but as a positively valued and exceptional experience of God, typically a highly eroticized one. Here then, martyrdom is positively to be welcomed, but still you must wait to receive it. Actively seeking martyrdom remained a grave sin, both mockery and presumption. And in these cases of martyrdom, it also remains the case that the act of killing is not the martyrs, but of course the persecutors. The Jain practice of Samadhi Maran, by contrast, is first of all not an extraordinary and exceptional experience of, and is not also a gift from, God, but a perfectly logical and continuous culmination of a normal religious life. It is extreme. Few people go so far as to do it, of course. But that is a matter of the frailty of the human spirit and will. Every lay Jain understands and accepts that really, in the end, to undertake a fast of this kind is the only wholly consistent and coherent response to the Jain religious vision. And although the matter is a bit complicated, we shall return to the complications in a minute, undertaking a fast to death is not, as is the case with martyrdom, something that happens to you. So it's not someone else's act, not even God's. It is something you must decide and vow to do, and something you must sustain and carry through. Various aspects of the practice, not least the fact that it takes so long, clarify the fact that this really is the dying person's own intentional action, an exercise of his or her will. Although Samadhi Maran is, in these respects, structurally different from martyrdom, and therefore very different from, quote-unquote, our ideas of death in the name of religion, the general idea of a good death as the defining telos of an ethical system is not entirely foreign, of course, to the West. The idea that a good death is a necessary part of a full conception of a good life is one we find in Aristotle, in a modern moralist such as Foucault, and his ideas about this were no less bizarre than Jain ones, and in a very great many authors in between. As it happens, it seems to me that in general, in contemporary ethical discussion and debates about a good death are pretty conspicuously absent, squeezed out by a combination of the dominance that crude utilitarian thinking has on our public life, on the one hand, and the so-called professional ethics, especially those of the medical profession, on the other. Now, I can't begin properly to justify here the claim I've just made, the claim that is that we don't have a very developed idea of a good death and don't discuss what a good death would be very much in our public life. It's not in any case necessary for the purposes of this paper. I do just want to point, however, to the contrast in this regard between the rationale for the Jain practice and contemporary arguments in favour of euthanasia and mercy killing, since these might seem at first sight to be rather similar. Debates about medical euthanasia and assisted suicide are concerned quite largely with questions of what makes a human life no longer worth living. Suicide or euthanasia might become justified, according to their supporters, when it's no longer possible for someone to enjoy those things that make life worth living. In the absence of those goods, whatever those goods are agreed to be, ending one's life or helping another to do so might become potentially justified, the argument goes. Thus, we find ourselves, for instance, invited to consider video footage on television to judge whether a brain-damaged patient shows signs of consciousness, or of human affection, or of pleasure. These are the goods, consciousness, affection, pleasure, that we are being asked to consider might make human life worth living. If they are present, the life should be preserved, and specifically medical professional ethics insist in general that it must be. If not, then for some at least, especially those whose ethical thinking is predominantly utilitarian, this provides a possible justification for ending that life. And that's the argument that those who wish to end the lives of their family members use, and use in court. So the argument works insofar as it works, a question I want entirely to leave to one side, insofar as it works, it does so from a supposed negation of the qualities that make life worth living. A life that is worth living should, of course, be prolonged. Although we might be dimly aware that we wouldn't really want to have our lives prolonged indefinitely, to live literally forever, however full and satisfying that life was, there's almost no way that that intuition, or any of its potential implications, finds its way into public policy discussion or ethical debate. In the Jain case, Samadhi Maran stands in a completely different relation to conceptions of a good life. It follows from success rather than from failure, damage, or misfortune. It's justified and virtuous in Jain thinking just to the extent that you've achieved a fulfilled and successful religious life. It's the next stage and fully successful completion of such a life. There's no point of reversal, as there is in that discussion of assisted suicide or euthanasia, where life becomes no longer worth living and the best that can be done is to salvage some dignity from the end. Samadhi Maran becomes most glorious and most virtuous in Jain thinking when the way you live already points inexorably in that direction, when your life is good just because it is a life worth leaving. In order to build up for you a picture of why and how this is so, I want first to explain the broad outlines of Jain soteriology, the religious vision in terms of which fasting to death makes logical sense as the telos of a good life. And then to compare and contrast this Jain practice briefly with a couple of other forms of quote-unquote good death in Indic cultural traditions. According to Jain religious teaching, and on these points the tradition is consistent and unanimous from the very earliest texts, the universe may be divided into two kinds of substance, jiva or soul matter, and ajiva or inanimate matter. These two kinds of substance are fundamentally unalike, but they are everywhere mixed together. Each soul, in itself as it were, is perfect. If unencumbered by inanimate matter, it would float to the summit of the universe, there to subsist forever in a state of omniscient bliss. But instead, the world is full, literally full, because they are everywhere, of souls that are encumbered by matter and therefore trapped in an earthly body. They live lives of intermittent but unavoidable suffering. They die, usually in pain and terror, and then they are reborn, always in pain and terror, and live another life, also punctuated at the very least by suffering in another and different body. This might be as a human, or as an animal or plant, or as an insect. Or it might be as one of countless invisible creatures that live and die in just a few moments, in fire, air, water, and in the ground. Even the gods, who live in an elaborate hierarchy of heavens and the equally stratified inhabitants of hell, live as such only for finite periods, at the end of which they re-enter the cycle of birth, death, and suffering by being born again in another body. The only way to escape all of this is from a human life by following the teachings of Jainism. Each action by each living thing, including, of course, thoughts, has an effect upon the soul because it causes to be attached to the soul certain kinds of matter. When the living thing dies, this matter will determine what kind of body the soul is reborn with. This happens according to a broadly ethical logic. Good deeds bring a relatively good rebirth, wicked deeds a lowly one. Persistent greed, for example, will ensure that your next rebirth will be one in which you are poor. Didactic stories aimed at children can be very vivid and drive home the central message of these teachings, that because the world is full of living things, any action, however apparently innocent and trivial, is potentially harmful and therefore damaging to the self. In one story, which I found in a book for children, a man took pleasure and pride all his life in his ability to peel mangoes so that the skin all came off in one piece. He was reborn as a criminal who, when convicted, was condemned to be skinned alive. That cheered them up before bedtime, I imagine. This you will recognize as a version of the Pan-Indic idea of karma, that your actions will affect your future life in this life and also your fate in the next. For Jains, living things literally fill the space around us and everything we come into contact with. So all our movements and bodily processes involve the destruction of other living things. One of the very oldest texts of the Jain canon explains in detail, for instance, why even plants, as they derive sustenance from the ground, thereby destroy other creatures living in the soil and are therefore guilty of sin. The regulations laid down for Jain monks and nuns set out a comprehensive program for getting out of this predicament. Even if these rules are followed rigorously, it will take more than a single lifetime to be entirely successful, because you need not only to avoid action that will cause further karma, you need also to remove that which you have already accumulated in over this and previous lifetimes. The idioms Jains use most to think about this is that karma must be burnt from the soul by the heat generated by austerity, by disciplined meditation and confession, by enduring physical deprivations, and most of all, by fasting. This is often expressed by the idea that sacrifice, which was and in altered ways remains a central part of Brahminical Hinduism, is internalized in Jainism. One performs sacrifice within one's own body rather than externally by killing some living thing. In order to purify that body and to remove the accretions that keep the soul trapped within it. For monks and nuns, as I have said, Jain tradition lays down a comprehensive regime of how to rid the soul of karma and progress towards purification and final release from embodied suffering. For lay Jains, there is an immense battery of vows and elaborately enumerated practices they are enjoined to adopt, which, even if only fitfully and intermittently, take them slowly along the same path towards the same goal. Periodic fasts are an indispensable part of this, and these come in a variety of forms, which impose various restrictions on diet, including removing just certain things from the diet, but up to and including prohibition of all food of any kind, including water, for periods, for instance, of 1, 8, 14, or 28 days. And there are more complex scripted fasts, usually associated with mythological charters. A famous Jain saint is said to have fasted for a year. Jains today emulate this story of the ancient mythic past by fasting on alternate days for a little over a whole year, 400 days in fact. A recent newspaper report from Bombay records a huge ceremony at which 250 monks and nuns were among the crowd that witnessed some 1,300 lay Jains successfully complete this fast and take their fast-breaking meal consisting of a drink of sugarcane juice. That this prolonged penance is thought of as something that enhances their life is indicated not only by the lavish display and ceremonial, but also by the fact that it seemed to the lay Jains in the crowd to be perfectly natural that they take this event, this long extended fast, as an opportunity for 11,500 of them to make a blood donation for medical purposes. So that blood donation was tacked onto this celebration of a long fast. Fasting is important, but it's by no means the only kind of austerity that takes a Jain towards the purification of the soul. For instance, it's a common practice for lay Jains to adopt, either for fixed periods or permanently, a set of restrictions called the 14 disciplines. Like all Jain austerities, one adopts these by taking a binding vow. The exact extent of the restrictions one places oneself under is variable, but having taken the vow, one is bound to try to fulfill it. The 14 disciplines involve restricting, for example, the number of kinds of food one eats, the number of items of clothing one wears, the number of pieces of furniture one uses, the number or kind of vehicles one travels in, the direction and distance one travels in, and so on, and so on. Now, the general tendency of these restrictions is clear enough. They completely eliminate spontaneous action, anything motivated by desire or appetite, and replace it with constant self-monitoring and discipline. One reins in the extent of one's activities in order, as the Jain idiom goes, to reduce oneself to zero. Even sleep is a discipline. One should learn to lie completely still while sleeping and never to move about in one's sleep. A devout Jain may, in later life, progressively adopt more and more such restrictions by taking ever more restrictive vows. It's important to realize that these restrictions and periods of fasting are regarded quite literally as improving one's bodily health. The dietary restrictions Jains place themselves under are all explained as ways of cleaning, purifying, and strengthening the body, making it more resilient and therefore a better instrument for the purification of the soul. The body reduces in bulk, becomes harder and stronger, less prone to illness, less needful of sleep, less prey to the infirmities and distractions of sexual desire or desire for food and sensations such as heat and cold. It is in the context of this kind of project for training the body, better to be an instrument for improving the soul, that fasting to death makes sense. It becomes simply the next stage of progressive training and discipline, the logical endpoint of reducing the body to zero. It does seem to be illogical to think of improving, strengthening, and perfecting something to the point where it ceases to exist. But Jain religious iconography captures just this apparently paradoxical idea. In most Jain traditions, regular temple worship takes place before statues of deities and saints. The higher the religious status of the figures depicted, the less personalized is the representation. The fewer the defining features, the more they look like each other. After the death and final liberation of the greatest of these saints, they become, as I've already said, liberated souls, entirely and forever freed from an actual body. But these liberated souls are represented as if they somehow retained a memory of their final body, for they appear simply as the outline of a human figure seated in meditation. This is sometimes done with metal figures, so a metal sheet in which a hole is cut that's the shape of a seated human figure, and that hole represents the liberated soul. So there's nothing there, but it has a shape, nevertheless, of the human being who it was. That's to say, the liberated soul is represented by extrapolating from the progressive perfection, standardization, and simplification of the living body as it approaches enlightenment, as one of a series of identical empty outlines. For people who come to see the perfection of the self as progress towards reducing the body to zero in this kind of way, a fast to death can, under a variety of circumstances, come to seem the natural next step. With old age and infirmity, it can become the only way in which one can continue to hold to the vows one has already taken, such as those like the 14 disciplines I mentioned earlier. Here the conclusion looks superficially like the arguments we hear in our society by those in favour of euthanasia, but only superficially. And the Jain position is arrived at by an entirely different route. In circumstances such as old age or infirmity, the only way progressively to continue to do the body good is to bring it to a controlled end. Such people are presented with a choice between going backwards by breaking vows they've already taken, or continuing to progress and complete their life in a positive fashion. There are many examples of Jain renouncers, and fewer but a still non-negligible number of lay people, who are mostly elderly but still in good health, and who take a vow to fast to death in this way. They reduce food intake progressively until at last they give up even water. They sit in meditation, reciting the Jain litany until they lose consciousness and death follows shortly afterwards. Because it shows that the body, as a result of religious practice, is strong and resilient, the most prestigious and elaborately celebrated of these deaths are those which take longest to accomplish. That's to say, those which occur at the end of the longest continuous fast. In the earliest texts, fasting to death is described as a solitary practice. The monk finds a place on a mountaintop or some other secluded spot, preferably on a flat stone surface. He spreads this with grasses, sits in a meditational posture, takes his vow, and, as the texts all say, waits without eagerness for death to come. The provision about a stone surface and grass is not usually explained in the texts, but the reasons are clear enough from other aspects of the code of conduct for Jain renouncers. They're not allowed to use modern plumbing in bathrooms or flush lavatories at all, but must find a secluded spot by themselves and cover their bodily waste with sand or dry earth to minimize the extent to which it feeds insects or bacteria, since the birth and death of these life forms would be violence caused by the renouncer, so sin which they should attempt to avoid. The grass covering for the site for a fast to death plainly has the same purpose. As the body weakens and control of bodily functions is lost, the same care to absorb and dry human waste, and thereby not cause violence, is provided for. The fast is initiated by a formal vow, and in later texts, and very firmly in contemporary practice, this vow should be a public declaration made before witnesses and a senior religious teacher. The permission of a senior renouncer is normally sought to ensure that the decision is mature and calmly made for the pursuit of religious ideals, and that it is not an impetuous, passionate, and certainly not a despairing one. In most respects, Jain funeral rites exactly parallel those of Hindus of similar caste and class. But one vitally important set of Hindu practices is entirely missing from the Jain equivalents. One of the most weighty duties on a Hindu man is to be present at his parents' cremation. Once the fire is well underway, he takes a log and uses this log to smash the deceased parent's skull, thereby releasing the soul so that it could begin its journey to its next life. The soul should not have to leave the parent's body through one of that body's existing polluted orifices. Thereafter, the son must make an extended series of sacrificial offerings, called Shraddha, to feed the now disembodied soul and sustain it as it makes its way to a new life in a new body. The kind of new body it is reborn in depends, according to popular Hindu belief, on being properly provided for in this interstitial period. Without these offerings, there's a danger that the soul will fail to be reborn properly and become instead a malevolent ghost, which will haunt and persecute the family members who have neglected it. Right up to and including the cracking of the skull, Jains perform exactly the same series of rites, but they never perform the Shraddha ceremonies. I should emphasize that this is quite a remarkable and pointed deviation, because in the rest of their death rituals, their marriage rites, and the way they mark the birth of their children, the Jains all follow common Hindu practice. But Shraddha rites would flagrantly contradict Jain teachings on karma and rebirth. Jain teaching is that the soul proceeds instantaneously at the time of its death to its next body. So there isn't this interstitial period during which the soul requires to be fed. And to a considerable degree, the body to which it goes is influenced by the state of mind of the dying person at the moment of death. To gain liberation, the mind must be completely tranquil, free from all fears or desires, and basically the closer one is to equanimity in the last few moments of life, the better will be the next rebirth. So that from this point of view, the preparation of training the body is preparation for being in the right state of mind at the moment of death. Death by fasting is designed to help achieve this objective, as Abhachanji's daughter's description of his death was clearly intended to convey, if you think back to the words and the description that she gave of her father's death. The details of her account indicate her confidence about the extent of his success. His skull cracked spontaneously. That's the cracking sound she described having been heard, and then people saw that his skull was broken. And this indicates that even before his death, his soul had attained a very high level of perfection and therefore power. He did not need a son to come to his cremation after his death and crack open his skull to release it. In effect, she was saying that he performed his own funeral rites before his own death. Allowing his soul to escape its now superfluous body by the purest route, before it had even begun to decay and decompose. And he did so without requiring the help of his family members, having attained the detachment and autonomy that's needed for full enlightenment and liberation. She said that he died reciting the Samayak prayer. Devout lay Jains take the best part of an hour each morning to sit and recite this prayer in meditation. The final lines of the prayer are as follows. Cessation of sorrow, cessation of karmas, death while in meditation, the attainment of enlightenment. O holy Jinnah, friend of the entire universe, let these be mine, for I have taken refuge at your feet. The Uttrajayan Sutra, one of the classical central texts of the Jain canon, contains the following sentence. Death against one's will, is that of ignorant men, and it happens to the same individual many times. Death wins with one's will is that of wise men, and at best it happens but once. If we look now at the largely Hindu milieu which Jains and Indians inhabit, we find qualified recommendations of a number of different forms of religious suicide. These have never been entirely uncontroversial, and never as generally accepted as death by fasting has been among the Jains. There are plenty of references, especially in traditional Indian legal codes, to condemnations of suicide in general, and to some of these practices in particular. Some are figured as extreme expressions of devotion. So you may throw yourself from a mountain sacred to a particular god or goddess to whom you are particularly devoted, or drown yourself in his or her sacred river. Jainism has generally been hostile to all of these practices, although they're, as I say, controversially but nevertheless often praised in Hinduism in general. And Jainism has been fairly consistent in commending only its own practice of controlled fasting to death. But in broad terms, the religious language and symbolism the Jains have at their disposal overlaps very extensively with Hindu idioms. They have influenced each other so much on the whole and for the whole of their histories that if believers didn't themselves insist that they were separate religions, observers would not feel much need to regard them as such. I want, therefore, briefly to end this lecture by taking a couple of examples of, broadly speaking, Hindu ideas of religious suicide to see how they relate to the Jain ideas and practices I've been describing. One prominent form of fast unto death in Hindu public life, although it very rarely results actually in death, is that which occurs as part of a protest or demonstration, as a form of moral suasion. People sit outside the house of a debtor and vow to fast till death if necessary, until the debt is paid. Or they sit outside government offices vowing to fast until their grievances are addressed. The hunger strike in our own political life is a similar kind of action. Some of Mahatma Gandhi's celebrated fasts unto death, none of which, of course, ended in his actual death, appear to have been in this tradition. He several times announced that he would fast until a bout of communal violence, for instance, subsided, or until some political impasse had been overcome. It's interesting, however, that he always denied that his fasts were protests or forms of moral pressure, and he preferred to give an account of them that aligned them much more closely with the Jain practice. We should remember that, in addition to the influence of Raichan Bai, before the latter fasted to death, second of the examples I mentioned at the beginning, if you remember, Gandhi mentioned as a great influence on him. In addition to that influence, we should remember also that Gandhi's mother was a Jain, and he grew up in a trading caste Hindu milieu in which intermarriage with Jains is common. Gandhi rationalized and explained his own fasting, including his celebrated political fasts, by insisting that he was not fasting in order to pressure or blackmail other people to behave as he wished. Instead, he insisted he was working on himself, attempting, by the moral and spiritual force of his own self-purification, to destroy his own bad karma, and, by a sort of radiating effect of this self-purification, to remove the bad effects of his own sinful actions and his own faults on those around him, thereby causing them to behave better in turn. He sought then, as it were, to clean and purify the world around him, beginning with and by means of cleaning his own body through fasting. While most Jains think that their austerities will generally affect only their own future fortune, they agree that especially holy people can have this kind of effect. Jain literature contains descriptions of general peace and harmony arising, for instance, in the vicinity of great Jain saints. So they have pictures of a Jain saint sitting in the forest in meditation and wild animals and their normal prey sitting happily around him. And even for ordinary people, the good effects of religious fasts are not entirely individual. Women especially regularly fast for the health and well-being of their families. Gandhi's political fasts, then, were fundamentally built on the same logic as those of a pious Jain parent seeking to protect his or her family by fasting. The problematic aspect of this kind of thing for Jains is the question of desire and purpose. A fast which someone undertakes in order to achieve some practical effect in the world, whether it be the health of their family, getting a new job, passing an examination, or even general peace and goodwill, not only will not work, but because and insofar as it's an expression of worldly desire and attachment to things or other people in this necessarily violent and sinful world, because and insofar as it's an expression of desire of this kind, it will be positively counterproductive, Jain teaching insists.